Hi, everybody, and welcome to this edition of the podcast Disability Talks, an Illinois Guardianship and Advocacy Commission perspective. This podcast was created to provide information about disability rights and disability advocacy in the state of Illinois through a topic-based interview format. The podcast will be offered quarterly and will cover some of the issues that Illinois Guardianship and Advocacy Commission discovers and confronts in our work with the disability community. The Illinois Guardianship and Advocacy Commission is an agency in the Illinois state government. The agency is comprised of three divisions that advocate for disability rights in the state. The first division is Office of State Guardian, which provides guardianships as appointed by a court for adults with disabilities when no one else is able to serve. The second is Legal Advocacy Services, which provides legal representation for individuals receiving mental health services involuntarily. And finally, there's the Human Rights Authority, which investigates allegations of rights violations against individuals with disability by disability service providers. In addition to the work of the division, the Human Rights Authority and Legal Advocacy Services work together to operate the agency's special education initiative. And this initiative enables the agency to provide advocacy tools to families and students navigating special education services in Illinois public schools. We also want to add that while the Illinois Guardianship and Advocacy Commission does offer some legal services, this podcast is all about sharing information. We're not giving legal service here. It's important to know that you shouldn't use this podcast as a substitute for professional legal help. So this episode deals with supported decision-making. Joining us for the podcast are Teresa Parks and Laura Hart. Teresa, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Sure. Thanks, Jane. My name is Teresa Parks, and I am Deputy Director for the Illinois Guardianship and Advocacy Commission, where I also serve as Director for the Commission's Human Rights Authority.
And Laura, would you like to introduce yourself?
Sure. My name is Laura Hart. I am the Human Rights Authority Special Education Advocate. So I provide advocacy and supervise the other advocates within the program.
All right. Thanks to you both. So as I said, this topic is supported decision-making. So the first question is, what is supported decision-making?
Well, Jean, supported decision-making is an alternative to guardianship that's currently available to adults with intellectual and developmental disabilities who just need a little bit of assistance with decision-making, like we all do from time to time. The difference is that the Act, the Supported Decision-Making Act, provide some structure as well as some protections for people with disabilities. And this really originated when we started hearing from families of children with disabilities who are reaching the age of 18, adulthood. And they were questioning whether or not their child would need a guardian as they reached adulthood. And many of them had been referred for guardianship by special education programs. However, some of these parents were wondering, does my child need a full-fledged guardianship? But there really was no other option. So we started doing research on the concept of supported decision-making, looked at other state statutes, created a proposal that actually passed in 2021. And the effective date for supported decision-making in Illinois was February of 2022. So this has been in place in Illinois for 3 years now. And basically how it works is that person with disabilities called the principal under the act identifies another trusted adult to assist with decisions in area of life that they need help with. Those support arrangements are documented into a written supported decision-making agreement that's signed by both the principal, the person with disabilities, and the supporter. And they sign it in front of two other adult witnesses. And then the supporter simply helps the person in those areas of support. Two key things I want to point out and stress is that principal, the adult with disability, still makes all their final decisions. And secondly, even when there's a supported decision-making agreement in place, the principal, the person with disabilities, can act independent of that supported decision-making agreement if they so choose.
So you use the term supporter in your description. I want to ask some questions about that. First, who can be a supporter?
You know, it's interesting. The Act doesn't go into a lot of detail about who can be a supporter. It more or less stresses who cannot be a supporter, what are the disqualifications of being a supporter. Basically, a supporter has to be another adult. And the prohibitions or the disqualifications, that supporter can't be a person that has certain conflicts of interest. For example, they can't work for the principal or be an employer of the principal or provide certain kinds of support services or financial services for the principal or be a personal assistant to a principal, unless they are immediate family members. Family members who serve as an employer or personal aide can still be a supporter, but other individuals who might serve in those roles cannot be supporters. Supporters also can't be someone who has a finding of abuse or neglect against them, or they can't be someone who has an order of protection that prohibits contact with the principal. Supporter also can have a history of certain criminal crimes, such as a sexual offense, aggravated assault, fraud, theft, forgery, or extortion. So mostly disqualifications.
So you brought up family. Are they the people who typically become supporters, or who is usually a supporter?
From what I've heard in practice, typically supporters have been family members, parents, step-parents, adult siblings, or other adult relatives like aunts, uncles, cousins, and adult family friends are some examples of supporters. Laura, I don't know about you and your interactions in the special education world, if you've heard of other examples of supporters.
I think that's about right for kids that, well, students, they're not kids anymore. When they turn 18 and we're discussing that at school and they're trying to pick who their supporters are, it typically ends up being family members at that point. We have had some discussion about school staff, counseling staff. It really depends on the area that they're wanting support in when they are picking that. So there has been some odds and ends discussed, but I think mostly it ends up being parents.
Yeah, and I would just add to that, I think in some instances we've heard of former teachers, certainly current teachers could not be a supporter just because of that potential conflict of interest. But yeah, I've heard of former special ed teachers or former counselors serving in that role. So yeah.
And so it's you both said parents and teachers in the plural. Can you have more than one supporter?
There's nothing in the Act that would prohibit an individual from having more than one supporter. So an example might be, maybe there's a family friend who's an accountant and would be really good in helping with financial decisions. And maybe the principal might have a family member who's a medical professional and might be good in helping out with medical decisions. Whatever the case, they should have separate roles if you have more than one supporter. And you probably should have separate supported decision-making agreements. So it's very clear what that supporter's role is in that principal's life.
That's all interesting. I thought of a question that anybody listening might have. Is there a legal process to determine a supporter? Like, will someone need an attorney? What goes on with the, do you have to go to court?
That's part of the beauty of supported decision making. This is not a legal process. You do not have to take it before a court. You do not have to hire an attorney to establish a supported decision making arrangement. It's a private arrangement between the principal, the person with disabilities, and the supporter, much like a power of attorney is a private arrangement between two individuals. So it is not a legal process whatsoever. I have had or heard of one situation where individuals, family members brought supported decision-making to a judge during a disputed guardianship hearing. and the judge listened to information. This is right when supported decision making came out, and did not appoint the guardian, giving that individual the opportunity to try supported decision making before looking at a more restrictive guardianship approach.
Now, do these documents have to be notarized or anything?
They do not. We actually had it in the original version of the legislation to have the document, the supported decision-making agreement, notarized, but we heard from disability advocates that it's not always easy for people with disabilities to access a notary. So we removed that provision and substituted it with 2 adult witness signatures. I have heard, though, some individuals and families going ahead and having the document notarized anyway. There's nothing to prevent that. They feel like maybe it might be taken more seriously if it was notarized, but there's nothing in the act that requires it to be notarized. And the act also has a reliance statement that if someone receives the agreement, they are to rely on its content.
So I kind of want to throw in there too, when we're talking about those situations where people, because notaries come up a lot, and so the people are always worried about the validity of that agreement, especially in medical and financial situations. And I just want to throw out there that you can still sign and revoke consents at those institutions specifically, and you might be required to do so. So you may have a supported decision-making agreement and take it into your medical office. They may still want to do a release of information in order to provide information to those individuals. And so there may be other things in addition to that that need to be done based on what kind of supported decision-making agreement that it is. And that's totally normal.
Thanks, that's great to know. Somebody mentioned previously about, one supporter might be good at medical, one supporter might be good at like financial or something else. What are the different tasks that supporters take on kind of in general?
Well, the act defines the kinds of things a supporter can do. For example, they can help gather information about a decision. It's likely, as Laura mentioned, that a release of information will be required to actually access that information. Also, the supporter can help the principal weigh options around a decision, the pros and cons. They might help the principal develop questions to ask, for example, a medical provider about a medical procedure or medication. The supporter might help the principal schedule appointments, maybe even attend the appointments if the principal wants the supporter's presence. They also might help communicate the principal's decisions if needed. And they might also help advocate for the implementation of the principal's final decision as well.
So we're talking about medical appointments and things like that. I think people are probably wondering how facilities or agencies that you take someone to know someone has a supporter.
It's really up to the supporter and principal to get that document to involve service providers. It's really incumbent, and then service providers are to follow and rely on that agreement unless the principal says they don't want them to, unless they're otherwise informed by the principal. But the principal and supporter really need to share that document. I have heard in a couple instances that some people have also had to take this copy of the Supported Decision-Making Act with the agreement just to help educate service providers on supported decision-making as it's becoming more and more known. But that seems to have helped, and the act's not very long, so that's easy to do.
That's great advice to take the act with you.
You know, and one other thing I wanted to mention, we talked about supporter duties and what they can do. There are also prohibitions, things that supporters can't do. For example, they can't force a decision or make a decision, and they can't access information without the principal's permission. And I just want to make sure that people are aware of that.
Well, that's a good segue to my next question. So let's say a principal was going along and they don't like the whole process. They want a different supporter. You know, any number of things could happen. How does somebody terminate a supported decision-making agreement?
A supported decision-making agreement can be terminated at any time by the principal. They can simply tear it up. They can have someone else tear it up in their presence. They can write, date, and sign a statement that the agreement is terminated, or they can verbally express that the agreement is terminated in front of two witnesses. The supporter likewise can terminate an agreement if they don't want to be involved in the situation anymore. And they simply do that by giving notice to the principal. And we recommend that if they decide to do that, that the supporter gives the principal a couple of weeks notice in case they need to line up a backup supporter.
Excellent. Thank you. So how does supported decision making work in like a school setting for like transition or something like that?
So prior to a student turning 18, schools are required to discuss what's called a delegation of rights form. And so essentially a student turns 18 and they have all the decision making ability for their school records, for their IEPs, things like that. And so when that happens, we go through the options with them. And what that primarily breaks down to is a discussion about, you know, does the student have the capacity to make their own decisions? If they do, then they fill out a delegation of rights and determine, you know, whether they want their parent to continue to be involved in the decision-making process. That's specific to their parents for the delegation of rights. If they have capacity and they just would like some additional support, then that's when we go through the supported decision-making process and what that looks like and how that can be completed in order to put a supporter in place for educational, or if they need it beyond educational, what that looks like. The IEPs in and of themselves are an amazing practice for supported decision making long before a student turns 18. When we're talking to parents and talking about the option of supported decision making, that's the best example I have, is to sit with them and say, okay, well, IEPs for the last however many years have been an opportunity for the student to participate with a lot of support, a lot of different people in the meeting, helping make decisions, helping the parent make decisions with the student being a part of that team. And so they are now in a position at 18 to determine who they want to be a part of that. And so then if we have a student who doesn't have the capacity to make their own decisions, then we move on and talk more about other decisions like guardianship and more restrictive things. But anytime a student can make their own decisions, we want to make sure they understand their right to a supported decision-making agreement.
Thanks, Laura. Is there like a model supported decision-making agreement or like a specific form that has to be used?
Yes. Well, we have a form that we've created under the Act. Any supported decision making agreement form must substantially follow the form contained within the statute. And we have one available on our agency website. It can be downloaded, printed, and used. We also have a couple samples of releases of information forms that Laura referenced. We have one for school records, specifically for school records, and we have another release form for everything else. And our agency website has a host of materials on supported decision making. We've developed training for supporters as well as for principals. We have brochures. We have a frequently asked questions sheet, all of which are available for downloading and using from our website.
And if anybody's wondering, that is, the website is gac.illinois.gov. All right. Is there anything else either of you just want to add at the end, or,
you,
you know?
Yeah, Jean, if I could just, you know, we talked about the kinds of areas of support, and school is really a crucial time to look at supported decision making. As Laura mentioned, it's really kind of this, it could be the starting point. But even if you're out of school and you're beyond that, there are other ways a supporter might help. And some of the areas of support might include helping someone with their living arrangements, finding a place to live, whether it be a group home or an apartment. Some people might need help with financial decisions or medical decisions, as we talked about earlier. In addition, some people might need help with work-related decisions, maybe helping finding a job or helping to apply for public benefits. The range of areas of support, are unending, and we have some areas identified in the supported decision-making agreement, but there's also a way to identify more areas of support if someone needs help and or assistance in other areas of their life.
That's great. Thanks a lot. Appreciate the information, Teresa. Thanks a lot, Laura, for joining us and providing the info. I want to thank everybody for listening. If you have any questions about supported decision making or any of the Guardianship and Advocacy Commission services, again, please check out our website. It's gac.illinois.gov, or you can call our intake line at 1-866-274-8023. Thanks a lot, everybody, and have a great day.